afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. In February, Alaska's Governor Bill Walker declared a public health crisis in our state that is as vicious and searing and expensive as a massive earthquake or a devastating fire. It is the state's opioid epidemic. Facts tell the story. Across the U.S., drug overdose deaths are climbing because of opioid addiction. In 2016, Alaska's overdose rate exceeded the national rate. What are opioids? Why are the numbers climbing? What are the public policy strategies to combat this epidemic? To learn more, we've got a handful of experts here in the studio and on the phone from Juneau. Our goal today is to explain how Alaska got here and the ongoing strategies to stem this epidemic. Now, I'd like to say to our listeners, you are a part of this story with your questions or your own personal experiences. So two things I want to alert you to. We have good resources on our web. We'll talk about some studies. We'll talk about some books. Well, we have links to some of that information on our website. And also, here is the phone number. If you are listening and you want to participate or you have a question, in Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433, and statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752, and we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and our website is Alaska Public, and that's where you will find all the links. So let's get to our guests right off the bat. We just don't want to do a little round robin. Down in sunny, hot Juneau, we have Dr. Jay Butler, the state's chief medical officer. Welcome, Dr. Butler.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And here in the studio, we have Andy Jones, who is kind of an emergency response guy for DHSS. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much.
Really happy to have you. Next, we have Kathleen McLaughlin, who's the director of the
Partners Reentry Center.
Yes, Partner Reentry Center. She directs it, and you're going to learn more about why she's a part of this program. But it has to do with Vivitrol. And successful reentry into society.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, so happy to have you here. And then we also have Jill Green, who is a nurse practitioner, would that be right, at my health clinic, and also very involved in treating the public related to opioid addiction. So we're going to hear from all of them. But first, we're going to go back to Dr. Butler to just get a little bit of a landscape. What is the problem here? Why is Alaska at the top of one of the lists we don't want to be on the top of? Was it a perfect storm? Can you lay out a little bit of the landscape for us, Dr. Butler?
Well, sure. And let me start by saying I am comfortable using the term opioid epidemic because anytime we have a single cause of death that increases 3 to 4-fold over a period of only a couple of decades, I think that fits the definition of an epidemic. I liked your nautical analogy of the perfect storm. I'm going to use another one of a tsunami that has come in 3 waves. And like a tsunami, sometimes we don't actually feel the earthquake that triggered it. When we think about opioids, I think it's first of all important to start with what is an opioid. These are drugs that are either derived from the opium poppy or are synthetic analogs that function the same way. These chemicals bind to receptors in the brain, and they can be very good drugs. They are very good for analgesia, that is, suppressing pain. They suppress coughs. They control diarrhea. And they've been used for those purposes literally for thousands of years. As we look at the history in the 20th century, there's a history of as controls on opioids were implemented a little over 100 years ago through the Harrison Narcotics Act, there was a tendency to undertreat pain and to really avoid use of opioids. And so I think anytime we talk about the role of the healthcare system, we have to acknowledge that there's a history where opioids were not used in situations that were appropriate and that pain was oftentimes undermanaged. However, as we get into the late 20th century, things begin to change, and that's where I think the earthquake occurred that many of us did not notice at the time, with changes in how opioid prescriptions were marketed, changes in perceptions and expectations of pain management. One of the changes was the concept of quality of care being related to complete suppression of pain and a concept of pain as the fifth vital sign, which, looking back now, it's a little embarrassing to think that we didn't question it more at the time, because a vital sign is an objective measure. Blood pressure, pulse, respiratory rate, temperature, these are all things that can be objectively measured. And pain is a subjective experience that involves not only the pathology that may be causing the pain, but also emotional and even spiritual overlays that influence how someone will perceive pain. Certainly, I wouldn't, you were my patient, I wouldn't say on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your blood pressure today? Mm-hmm. And with that change in medical practice, there was a 3 to 4-fold increase in the rate of opioid prescribing that occurred from about 1995 through about 2010. And mirroring that was a 3 to 4-fold rise in overdose deaths related to prescription opioids. Unfortunately, if we look at some of the data from sources such as the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Study, which assesses pain across the population, there was no decline in reports of people who experienced chronic pain. So we were trying to treat pain. We had a bad outcome associated with it, and it doesn't appear that, at least at the population level, it was being very successful. Now, it's important to point out that for some people, opioids are good drugs, but for others, they're really the wrong drug at any dose, at any time. The second wave of the tsunami really came in about 2010. So because we had a much larger proportion of the population that were using opioids, and some of those people struggled with physical dependency, some with addiction, there was a ready market for the new influx of cheap and very high-quality heroin. Heroin had changed quite a bit from what it was back in the French Connection days, that much of the flow was coming out of Mexico rather than some of the grow operations in Asia. And that heroin really moved all across the continent. Heroin, of course, isn't a new drug either. It was developed at the end of the 19th century, and sometimes talk about this is the third opioid epidemic, the first being in the late 19th century, another being around 1960s and 1970s. And heroin was the very commonly used opioid at the time. Heroin in the interim was mostly an issue in inner cities on the East Coast, and the trade was controlled by oftentimes by inner city drug gangs. But with the influx of much more available and cheap heroin, it was being sold much more broadly out through cities in the West, out through the suburbs, and into the rural populations where there had been particularly high prevalence of use of prescription opioids. In the past 2 to 3 years, we've seen the third wave come in. And that's mostly involved fentanyl and some of the related high-potency compounds. And many of these are not commercially available drugs, but rather substances that come out of illicit labs, mostly in Asia, and that can be ordered over the Internet. And some of these substances are not even technically illegal. So that has been a new challenge for law enforcement to know how to control some of these very powerful very dangerous drugs. An example is U47700. It was an investigational analgesic. The U stands for Upjohn. That was the pharmaceutical company that was developing it. They abandoned it as a commercial product, but it is still being produced by some commercial labs overseas. Some of these are clandestine labs. And then it's available on the Internet, and we've seen at least four deaths related to U4, as we call it, in various parts of Alaska. So we know that type of medication is also being misused in Alaska. So altogether, we've seen a continual increase in the number of opioid overdose deaths. Some leveling of the number of deaths due to prescription opioids, but not really the kind of decline that we would like to see to levels of what they were prior to the mid-1990s. But superimposed on that, we've seen increases in deaths due to heroin as well as the fentanyls.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Butler, I thank you. That was fabulous, but I've made you talk straight for 10 minutes. I want to give you a chance to get a drink of water and take a breath. But I would like to talk about Alaska. Is there anything unique about Alaska? Or are we just part of that giant wave that, you know, you talked about these recurring? That's one question. Is there something about Alaska? And the second one is, obviously, there's a continuing audience for these painkillers. So I'd like you to comment on that. I mean, is there a consciousness that we are lacking, that we just want to not have pain? We don't have the tools to deal with pain other than to take a pill. So first, let's start with the Alaska thing.
Yeah, so related to how is Alaska unique, currently I don't think we're so unique anymore. We were a little later with the problem, primarily driven by economic drivers. This still may be somewhat true. Two or three years ago, when people talked about the price of heroin and would hear about a dose of heroin in Seattle being $5, some people would say, well, that's lower 48 costs, that's outside cost, it's much more expensive here. But I know when I was still seeing patients prior to coming into this job a little over 2 years ago, I had some patients who were telling me about $10 to $15 hits of heroin. So the price was coming down, at least in the cities. And so I think as the price has continued to fall, even in Alaska, we've seen some of the same shifts in use and some of the same problems as the lower 48. And I think it's important to recognize that the use of heroin today is very different than the use of heroin in the 60s and 70s. At that time, heroin was certainly considered a hard drug, but it was something that people oftentimes progressed to after using other drugs. Sometimes they just tried it out of the blue. Today, we find that the majority of people who are using heroin say that they first began to become dependent on opioids using prescription painkillers, whether that be something that they borrowed from somebody else or something that was prescribed to them by a provider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to just sort of tell people, if they've been listening to you and wondering what this show is about, heroin and opioids, this is Dr. Jay Butler. He's the chief medical officer for the state of Alaska. Our topic today is the opioid epidemic in Alaska, and we're going to spend the first half of the show kind of laying out the landscape, and then the second half, just generally, what are the strategies to combat it. But we do have fabulous guests in the studio, too. And Dr. Butler, do you want to let us jump in here and start discussing this, or do you want to do a little bit more of the landscaping?
Well, maybe let's just spend a minute talking about, so what do we do about this? We've laid out a problem. It certainly is concerning. Last year, more than 90 Alaskans lost their lives to opioid overdose. I think we see this all over the state, and there's very, very few people who haven't been touched in some way by this epidemic. I always like to quote my daughter's observation that when she was growing up as a teenager in Anchorage, she had not even heard of the idea of self-injection drug use till about the time she graduated from high school, whereas today, her six-year-old son can name somebody who died of a heroin overdose. Mm-hmm. I think that really reflects how it has been a problem that has touched all of our lives. And, you know, the number of deaths last year is more than twice what the number of deaths due to AIDS was at the peak of that epidemic in the 1990s in Alaska, and represents nearly one in every 40 deaths that occurred last year. And while we don't want to get too molecule specific as we talk about the challenges of substance misuse and addiction, while we want to recognize that more people die of alcohol-related disease in our state, if we look at premature deaths, actually all drug overdoses consume more years of premature death or years of life lost than even alcohol. So it's an important issue because not only is it of a sizable proportion, but it also takes people at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in terms of what to do, first of all, we need to save lives. And that's where naloxone can be life-saving. And we have Andy Jones there, as well as the other providers who can provide some more insight into how naloxone can be used. We also need to increase access to treatment, and we'll be talking, I'm sure, about medication-assisted therapy, and I think it's important to recognize that there's more than just medication, that the medication is to assist the therapy. So there's three major types of treatment. I think we're going to today talk primarily about naltrexone, which has some huge advantages, particularly for people who want to go with a complete abstinence-based treatment. But we also have to remove the barriers to treatment, which includes removing the stigma from addiction. And that's why shows like this are so important, so that we can begin to change the conversation about addiction, that it's not something we should be whispering about, and that it's also a physical condition that involves the brain, and one that does require medical management, sometimes for a long period of time. And then finally, we have to look at what can we do in terms of primary prevention. And I think of three issues at hand. One is controlling how we use prescription legal opioids to try and use the smallest amounts for the shortest amount of time, yet be able to use the drugs as needed in appropriate situations, but to really rein back that these are not the first line in acute pain syndromes, and that the amount of drugs that are being dispensed have untoward effects. We need to address the flow of illicit drugs into our state. And then finally, we also need to address what are some of the drivers for self-medication. What are some of the ways that we can increase resiliency and particularly give our young people the coping tools so that drugs are not something that they would want to turn to?
I have one question for you. Someone said this to me. They said, meth is still bigger than opioids in Alaska, but people don't immediately die from meth. It's a long, long process if they do. Would you agree with that? And is it because we don't really know how every single body will react to an opioid?
Well, I don't know. I could say for sure that we have visibility on that interval between first usage to the time of death, but I can say we've seen increases in the number of methamphetamine deaths in recent years. So it's really important to recognize, again, that this discussion needs, even though we're primarily talking about opioids today, we need to have a broader discussion that is not so molecule-specific.
Right.
And that's actually kind of like the issue with alcohol. Alcohol kills more people, but the interval between getting into the issue of a substance use disorder with alcohol and dying of an alcohol-related disease, it's much longer than that interval for opioids, which is one of the reasons why it's particularly challenging.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring up marijuana because it's now legal in our state. Is that on the spectrum there?
Well, I would say it is, although the prevalence of users that develop a marijuana use disorder is more on the order of that of people who drink alcohol who develop alcoholism. It's relatively low in terms of the overall proportion, but if the the proportion of the population that uses becomes large enough, it could be a significant problem, just as alcoholism mm-hmm. is. Another probable similarity between alcohol and marijuana is use that begins during adolescence, maybe a particular risk factor for problems with misuse later in life.
Of alcohol, of marijuana, of anything?
Really anything, because mm-hmm. that's a period of time when the brain is going through some of its final preparations for mm-hmm. adulthood, and that process actually extends into the 20s. So it's nothing magic that happens when you become of legal age of 18. And I'm not a neurobiologist, but the term that is oftentimes used is neural pruning. Part of the reason you know everything in the world when you're 14 is you've got lots of neurons that are very active in the brain. And then there's a period of about 10 years as the neurons are pruned back a bit. And so it's an important time for learning. It's an important time for conditioning. And Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, has described addiction as a learning disorder, that the brain is trained to be able to depend on whatever substance, and that we have to look at it as a treatment of addiction as in part is a process of relearning.
Very interesting. I'm going to throw out our phone numbers for our listeners just in case people are thinking about this and either want to express something about it or ask a question. In Anchorage, that number is 550-8433, or we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Butler, what do you say we get these guests in the studio to earn their chairs here?
You've got some people there who know more than I do, so let's give them the microphone.
All right, but please continue to weigh in. This is very conversational, and if something occurs to you, Dr. Butler, we welcome you to, you know, converse with us. So, Andy, we were going to go to you next. Andy Jones, you are the chief emergency response.
As I was gonna say, you can call me anything you want, but yeah, my my job is to manage disaster response capabilities within the health and medical field at the state of Alaska.
So you're talking earthquakes.
It can be anything
tsunamis.
From a pandemic flu. You know, if we had Ebola up here, any type of outbreak to. Of course, definitely tsunamis, natural disasters. So,
what qualifies something to be a natural disaster? I know I opened this saying the governor declared this, but
that's a great question. So, as an incident commander, two things that we always look at is loss of life and loss of property. Those are the first things we always analyze. And a lot of people ask me, "What's the number?" And it's not always about the number of lives lost or a number, you know, of property lost. Obviously, when you're working with the federal government or the state, it's about it may be cost to the property, but lives is a different story. The other thing we look at is the local communities. Have they exceeded their capability? Do they need help? And so when we put this all together, those are the questions we ask ourselves. And we don't declare disasters every day, obviously, and there's a lot of thought process behind it. So with the opioid epidemic, that was one of the things we went out and did. We worked with local jurisdictions. So Juneau's got a local task force. MATSU, Anchorage has started one up. But we go around and we ask providers, we ask the civilians, have you exceeded your capability? What are you currently doing? How could the state come in and help? You know, and based off all that analysis, we then work with the governor's office, our commissioners, and we put forward a disaster deck packet. Mm-hmm. So those are definitely some of the factors, especially when you're looking at a public health emergency like this. Mm-hmm. We're like Dr. Butler said, we're seeing these rapid rising trends of overdoses in our state. And so we don't want to turn in, you know, we don't want to see, you know, 60 overdoses in one day. So how do we get in front of this epidemic mm-hmm. and try to resolve it?
And, you know, I think people might assume it's a city problem. But we heard from Dr. Butler that a lot of things are available via the internet and the mail. So could you kind of give me a feel for where it's happening in our state?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to start with you where you said it's a city problem. One of the things I think us as a state, all of us, it's more of a whole community or whole state problem. And what I mean by that is the epidemic isn't just affecting Anchorage, but it's affecting MATSU. It's every corner, Kotzebue, ADAC, you name it, it's every corner of the state from the conversations I've had. The other piece that's really important is we all rely on each other. And the story I can tell is we had an individual who needed detox capability in the Mat-Su, and there was nothing available there, nothing in Anchorage, so they had to go to Fairbanks. So it's not a city issue. We all have to all come together. Mm-hmm. To make this work. We're all doing great work. Sometimes we focus on our area, you know, we kind of silo on that, but how do we link it all together, put mm-hmm. all the puzzle pieces together?
Mm-hmm. So you are the person who is working on getting these kits out to rural communities. I think it's called Narcan.
It is. So Narcan is the name brand, but naloxone is actually the medication.
Okay.
So naloxone is an opioid antagonist, and I'm going to break it down to the simplest form. We actually have receptors in our brains. These receptors control our breathing, our respiratory rates, a few other things. Opioids are very much attracted to these receptors. So if you're thinking, what does a receptor look like? I always like to say, look at like a wine goblet gas. You know, you got that big opening, and that opioid wants to just come and sit and rest right on it. And the mm-hmm. more that you have these opioids, prescription or illicit drugs, that rest on these receptors, it controls your respiratory rate to where it slows down and gets very dangerous and leads to an overdose. Mm-hmm. Now, naloxone, when it's administered, and there's different forms, the ones that we've got is through the nostril. They say intranasal.
Spray?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
spray. So no different than allergy medicine.
Mm-hmm.
When that is actually delivered, it's got a stronger attraction to that receptor than the opioid has.
Oh.
And so it kicks the opioid off. Now, what I want to tell people, they think, oh, it's out of my system. I'm good to go. That opioid's still in your system. And this drug or this medication only lasts for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. So we do provide two dosages. But I think the biggest and most important message is that individual must seek higher level care. 911 must be called because they can easily lapse back in. The other thing I want people to understand is that we're seeing this trend of synthetics coming across.
So fentanyl?
Fentanyl, U4770, there are some very strong synthetics that are coming into the street on the street market that naloxone doesn't really do much. And when it doesn't kick you out of that overdose, your best bet is CPR.
Wow.
Yeah. CPR is the foundation, I would say, to keeping an individual alive if naloxone does not work.
Now, is the point to get these kits around the state and, you know, in public places? Almost, mm-hmm. I was thinking about those heart
like AEDs.
Defibrillators.
Yeah.
Is it that kind of an approach? Like if we have it in the cabinet and we think someone has overdosed, we've got the tool. Is that the approach?
That or how about an EpiPen?
Uh-huh. EpiPen,
right? Your child, me or myself may have an allergy. You should carry one of those. A lot of people will say, this doesn't affect me. I don't know somebody. But you'd be surprised. You probably do. They haven't either come out and told you they're addicted. So it's really good to have one of these kits.
Mm-hmm.
When we as a state looked at how are we going to distribute these kits out across our entire state, we looked at other states, and we took their best practices and looked at their, I wouldn't say failures, but areas of gaps, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And some states, what they do is they actually do a training with individuals, and then they give them a certification. They make them go to the pharmacy, and then they pick up their kit for free. That approach isn't bad, but the problem is there's stigma. We've heard that word. Yeah. People are, not everybody, but a lot of people are embarrassed to be using technically, or if it may be a mom, dad, a son or daughter who knows somebody who's using, they don't want other people to know. So how do we make this program as simple as possible where they receive the training in a classroom, on the street, in a house, in their environment where they're comfortable so that they get the training 5 minutes long, 10 minutes at the most, and a kit's handed to them. I will be honest, this isn't the cure to the opioid epidemic. Like Dr. Butler said, I think this is what we would say the tip of the spear.
Mm-hmm.
This is what will give that individual who's actively still using the tools they need to stay alive
mm-hmm.
so then we can work to get that individual into treatment when they're ready and become an individual in recovery.
So does every village, does every town have, what would you say about your spread?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we started in February 15th. And a little bit of history there. That's when we declared the disaster. So we did that because we needed the statutory authority to distribute Narcan.
Mm-hmm.
So what we decided as a state is we said, let's create an overdose response program that is a blanket. So an individual, a recovery group may not have medical oversight. They can take our training, and then with that statewide medical standing order, they are covered to distribute. They can be an ambassador of Project HOPE, and HOPE stands for harm reduction, overdose prevention, and education.
So say you're in a sort of self-help group,
yeah,
and you meet weekly or daily,
yeah,
or whatever, while you're working on whatever problem that a group
that
might have. What about schools? Are schools another?
You know, schools are an area we want to focus on. We started, though, with, I think it was great you brought up the self-help or the peer recovery coaches. So when you look at individuals who have been actively using or they were addicted, potentially maybe still have that addiction, people in recovery talk to people in recovery more than they're going to talk to me or Jill or any of us here, right?
Or their teacher.
Yeah, definitely. Uh-huh. So it's the same thing. A vet talks to a vet, you know.
Right.
I mean, so that's why we wanted to equip that group first. You know, we wanted to equip individuals in recovery, peer recovery services, but also our clinicians, but really empower those individuals who are in the trenches.
Okay.
Who...
Let me just ask this one question,
and
then we have to take a little break and cool off our ears for a second. But this Narcan, but the exact drug,
naloxone, yep,
is given at the point of overdose. It is not.
Most times when an individual, and these are just the stories I hear on the street right now, or has a medic in the past, is usually when we roll up, the individual is in an overdose, and we do apply the naloxone medication to the individual as a first step to trying to kick them out of that overdose. Like I said, if that doesn't work, we go to CPR.
Right. Well, I know we're going to talk about Vivitrol in the second half of the show, and so I want it to be clear to people what the difference between those is. And you don't have to explain that all right now, but we will. Because I think it can be muddy in your average person's mind, all these different names. So, good topic. Lots to talk about. Just to remind you, we're talking about the opioid epidemic in Alaska. We have Dr. Jay Brettler on the phone from Juneau. We have Andy Jones here, who's an emergency response guy. Whether it's an earthquake or an opioid epidemic, that's the kind of work he does. We also have Kathleen McLaughlin, who is director of the partner. I always screw that up. Let's see. Partners for Progress Reentry Program. How's
right.
that? Okay.
That works.
Okay, great. And you've been quiet. You and Jill Green have been so quiet, but you're gonna earn your keep in the second half hour. So we'll be talking about Vivitrol and also patient care, really, which is, you're on the sort of overarching, Andy, you're sort of the strategy, and we're also going to get down to what's it like to treat patients as well. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm going to just remind you who our guests are and give you the phone number because this is a big news story in our state. There's been a lot of coverage, and I want to give a shout out to the other local news organizations here at Alaska Public Media, Alaska Dispatch News. People have been writing about this in a serious way. Today's show is a chance to kind of get the landscape on the opioid epidemic and hear what some of the public health strategies are. So we've got Dr. Jay Brettler in Juneau. We've got Andy Jones here in the studio, Kathleen McLaughlin, and Jill Green. We're just going to go right back to let me give out the phone number, too, in case people want to call. 550-8433 in Anchorage, or we'd welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we're going to go back to Andy just a little bit for a little bit of that scope.
Yeah, great. So, Dr. Brettler talked about on February 15th, the governor declared a disaster. And like we said, it's no different than a fire or an earthquake. What's unique is this is the first time ever in Alaskan history that the Department of Health and Social Services have actually declared a public health emergency.
Oh, so I did not know that.
Yeah, so that really shows how bad this epidemic
really is.
Yeah. A lot of the times, people see federal government or state government come in with a top-down approach when we manage a disaster. We're taking a different approach here. We're not just state individuals, not federal individuals, but we are inviting boots on the ground. So people like Kathleen and Jill come in, help guide us, tell us what works, what you're seeing out there, and how do we connect the pieces together. And, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years, and this is the most complex response that I have ever taken part of. You know, how do we boost up our recovery, peer recovery support services, and build a model that meets Alaska's needs, mm-hmm. you know, in the environment that we're in at this point.
And you're only a couple of months old.
Yes.
I imagine your horizon. I think it's a five-year funding program that you have,
yep.
right? This is federal money?
This is federal money for naloxone. And you're right, the response is only a couple months old. Since then, we've put out almost 5,100 and something kits into the state. It's not a lot. I mean, it's great. I'm excited that we are getting the kits out, but we have a long ways to go. I think response-wise, Dr. Butler says it better than anybody. This isn't a sprint. This is a marathon. And so we need to make sure we're in a response mode, but we start looking at recovery. How do we rebuild our community and rebuild a system, like I said, that really it may have worked years ago, but how do we continue to build it to meet our needs today?
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to shift over and talk about dealing with patients, but of course, the phones are starting to ring. So I'm going to try to take a few phone calls, and where the answer comes from, it can be any of you, but I've got Sue on the phone from Nome. Hi, Sue.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was driving. I'm pulling over.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I just wanted to say I am someone, in fact, I have flown into Anchorage to see my pain specialist because I'm somebody with such a badly injured spine that I rely on opioids to get, you know, to maintain my level of function. And I they put me on 8 months of OxyContin, so I know what it's like getting off of that drug. It's miserable. At the same time, my sister-in-law died of an opioid overdose. So I've experienced this from both sides. And I just want to, it's great to talk about the epidemic, but please, let's not forget the people who have a legitimate need and are using the drugs respectfully and properly, and not make it too hard, as it is for now in Nome, to actually get access to legally prescribed, appropriately prescribed opioids.
Got it. And I did hear Dr. Butler address legitimate use of opioid. Are you saying it's too difficult for you to get it when you need it? Is that what you're saying, or?
Pretty much. They've gotten very restrictive in Nome, and I prefer to work with one doc anyway, but yes, they have recently fired a doctor because she was prescribing of opioids, although I think there's been an overreaction for letting go of someone that served the community for over 30 years and was simply trying to help people with pain. She's helped me in the past.
Okay,
but
well,
it could be too restrictive.
Yeah. And I just want to say to Dr. Butler, is there any response to this? I mean, it's new. You know, this is a new strategy, but it sounds like, at least in some people's mind, there's a fear of an overreaction. Would you have anything to say to that, Dr. Butler?
Well, I think Sue nicely described the experience that oftentimes people have with opioids for prolonged periods, mm-hmm. is that most any of us will have some degree of physical dependency, and it requires some very careful titration down to be able to get off the medication. But I also really want to highlight that most people, even who take opioids for a long period of time, do not become addicted. Addiction is a different issue, and that's where you begin to have those more longer-lasting changes in the brain. The other issue that Sue brings up that I think is really important, and is one of the reasons I sort of started the historical review by pointing out for much of the 20th century, pain was undertreated, that finding that sweet spot of not overusing, but at the same time addressing the needs of chronic pain patients is not easy, but it's something we need to continue to work towards. One of the challenges that I think we really really do need to address is the habit of prescribing. Anytime the indication is just in case you need them, I think that's problematic. And I certainly have heard of a number of people still today, after relatively minor surgical procedures, that leave with 120 oxycodones or Vicodins. And that's where we begin to see the problem of either people becoming dependent and at risk of addiction, or diversion, because there's so many of these pills that are out there in our communities. In fact, there was recently a study from Dartmouth Medical Center that followed up on patients who'd had surgery and found that about 75% of all the opioids that were prescribed were never taken. So I think 75%? That really highlights that we can be more judicious in how we use these drugs.
All right. Well, Dr. Butler, I want to, we got a couple of people calling in, and we want to get to Kathleen and Jill a little bit here, too. So let me take another call from Alan. Hi, Alan. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Hey. Thank you for taking my call. My call is reference to emergency preparedness. I'm a respiratory therapist practicing at Providence Alaska Medical Center. And as such, you know, I work with a big multidisciplinary team of doctors, nurses, rad techs, lab people. And I was just wondering, with the state organization or committee, or what you guys were referring to, what's the makeup at the top? Is it just doctors? Is it a couple nurses here and there? Are there any respiratory therapists involved? What kind of approach do you guys have right now?
That's a great question, and like I was saying earlier, we don't want this to be a top-down approach of just state government. So we have everything. I don't think we have the specific career field you talked about, but we do have treatment providers, recovery coaches, individuals that manage detox centers, halfway houses. We are continuing to build the team. Even though we are 3 months into this, I would say the nice thing with ICS is it can scale up and scale down in size.
What is ICS?
Oh, sorry. The Incident Command System. The structure that we're using to manage. So we definitely like to get multiple vast different opinions, career fields in there that relate to the epidemic that help guide us. So it is a mixture of, I would say, local, tribal, state, and federal entities that are participating in our response.
Is there somewhere people can, if they want to get engaged, is there somewhere they do they call DHSS, or you know, if or do you think that medical providers are already getting, you know, a sort of the thread on where they should be if they want to get engaged with this?
You know, we've had a lot of outreach. I would say we have quite a few medical providers. I would say I never want to turn anybody away if they want to be part of it, but we don't want to get so big, obviously.
Right.
So projecthope@alaska.gov is a great place to connect up with. Just to let the individual who has asked the question to know that we are working with the Anchorage-based hospitals to meet the needs in the Anchorage Bowl area. So, for example, drug disposal bags, the potential for naloxone in the ERs, things like that right now.
All right. And Alan, we've got another call. I'm going to try to get to that third call and then get over here to Kathleen and Jill. So I'd like to welcome Don to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you? Real quick to start with, I'd like to get in a plug here for Neurology Now, which is a free magazine. Published free publication, comes out monthly, I do believe, and it's also on neurologynow.com.
Are you guys familiar with that? No? Okay.
Well, it's mainly about brain and development and other diseases related to it. I have lost between 1 and 2 people every year for about the last 5 years to ODs and whatnot. And it gets rather pathetic when you have to push people aside because they won't pay attention to you and take care of themselves anymore. What I wanted to get at was education on this. I haven't heard much of anything about the schools. I know we still teach chemistry. We still teach a lot of other things in schools. My question is, what are you people doing to take the message into the schools proper?
Well, that's great, and we will address that, Don. And so I'm going to thank you for your call, and we're going to move on and Go ahead, Jill. You want to jump in? Jill Green.
I will say the school nurses just contacted me last week to see if I would be interested in coming to speak to them. So we are trying to organize something on that front.
The ASDs, yep. Yeah.
And we are working. We have a school-based prevention team within the ICS structure that we are looking at course curriculum, engaging with our schools. We want students to be more engaged, help build some of the capability for us. And so it's, like I said, it's not just an adult approach, but we want, I mean, the questions they ask and the ideas they come up with are amazing.
Yeah.
And so that is if there's anything that's more important out here, is education is so important, and that's probably one of our number one focuses, obviously, that we're looking at right now.
Go ahead, Jill.
But I think, you know, a question that comes to me a lot is, how come I've never heard about, you know, our office? I don't think people really are educated about where they can go to receive services if they are suffering from opioid dependency. Mm-hmm. So that remains one of the biggest topics in the state.
I agree.
And are you talking about my health clinic, or are you talking about DHSS?
All of it. I would reckon most, even primary care providers on the front lines of treatment, really don't know where to send people throughout the state if they are seeking treatment for opioid dependency. So there is a website, Alaska 211, but that seems to be not quite up to date, because I've been treating people who have opioid dependency for 2 years. I'm not on the website. So, you know, I think that we need to build, as part of our infrastructure in the state, is a comprehensive access list of where to go for what.
And Jill's got a perfect point there. That's one of the gaps I've noticed also going across the state, working with the local task forces. So, for example, the MATSU local opioid task force, they've been working to build a list. And if there's any recommendation I can give to community leaders or community members out there, build a local task force. Anchorage just started one. And I think, like I was saying, there's a lot of great capabilities out there and people doing great work, but we need to link it all together. So somebody understands what is the continuum of care or the pathway to recovery. I mean, that is a big gap. If we can't tell an individual seeking treatment how to get through the system, then we're going to fail every time. And that's, I think, one of the most basic first steps we need to work on.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think it takes a village. I mean, everybody.
It does.
It takes a village. And that's how Kathleen McLaughlin and I got together, is we built a little village. You know, Kathleen works with prisoner reentrants, you know, who would maybe otherwise be homeless and really have very huge lack of resources when they are released from incarceration. But yet they miss this little piece called medical care. Yeah. And I said, what if we could create access, you know, through a very simple community collaboration to get people who come to her office to come to my office for the medical piece of it, and give them access to medication-assisted treatment for opioid dependency. And that's called, you know, it takes a village.
Right.
And sprinkling in that peer recovery service capability, somebody who is a guidance counselor that walks you through the system. And so you can see we're already kind of putting the pieces together. Mm-hmm. Now we need to put them, finalize it, and get it out to the public.
Right. Now, you talked, what was the N medication that you talked about?
Naloxone. Yes.
Now I want to talk about Vivitrol. And either Jill or Kathleen, let's talk about that so people understand in their minds how it's different from the N one.
Yep.
Okay. So Vivitrol is naltrexone, which sounds like naloxone, and they are similar. And just like Andy said, naltrexone binds to those opioid receptor sites in the brain as well, but it can stick a little longer. So it doesn't just work in the immediacy to get the drugs off of those receptor sites to get them out of overdose. Of course, it does do that. If you've ever given a little naltrexone to somebody who's actually actively using, they'll be not very well in a matter of minutes. Mm. But naltrexone has been around, they've been using it since 1984 in the pill form for opioid dependency and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And it's been out as an injectable form, which lasts for 4 weeks, since 2006 for alcoholism, and it was approved in 2010 for opioid dependency. And I would say that its utilization rates have been a little lackluster since then, and I'm not really sure why. Hmm. The benefit, I don't know a lot of people who take medication or vitamins that are really good about taking them every day as they're supposed to. And so to ask somebody who is dependent on opioids to take a pill every day to, you know, keep themselves in a safe harbor is probably asking a bit much. So literally, when you take naltrexone pill or you get an injection, it takes away your ability to get high if you use opioids. Of course, they were talking about drugs like fentanyl and U4. That,
synthetics.
You know, those, you know, maybe this won't be as protective for those types of medications. So that's going to create a whole new public health issue as that popularity increases. But the injectable naltrexone lasts for 4 weeks. And it binds to all those opioid receptor sites, so they can't get high for 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And I think that comes into play with the people who are reentering society from having served time in prison. I believe I've read that now it's possible for people to receive an injection before they leave prison.
Right. So what happened is in September 2015, Jill and I got together after we had seen some opioid deaths of people that came out of prison and they started to use heroin at the same level that they had used prior to going to prison, and they would immediately overdose and die. So in
why was that? Was it because their bodies had readjusted and then they went back to the original level?
Yes, because their tolerance decreased after a period of abstinence.
Okay.
So what we discovered is we had to think outside the box. And there's all these strategies, and I'm really proud of the state for taking this and looking for strategies. But one of the keys we have to do is let's look at the people that are in front of us right now. So Partners Reentry Center partnered with Jill and My Health Clinic, and we came up with a program, a pilot program, and it was as simple as this. As soon as somebody released, we would immediately enter them into our program, give them housing if they would otherwise be homeless, and if they had an opioid or an alcohol addiction, we would put them in a taxi, send them over to Jill, and we would give them Vivitrol that very day. Mm. Our statistics on that are about half said yes, we'll take the Vivitrol, half said no. Of the people that said, and there's about 200 people in the program now, of the half that did do Vivitrol, 75% are still out in the community. Of the people that said no, I'll do it myself, 98% are returned. They are incarcerated. What we found is, in this process that we are continuing to do statistics on, is that even releasing from incarceration, the moment you walk out the door, you are going to be triggered. Oftentimes, people are released to a family member who's sitting in a car with a line or heroin or something ready to give them to celebrate the release from incarceration. So the return and recidivism was just outrageous. So as a result, the Department of Corrections took a risk and said, and we asked and we really pushed for, can we have the first shot before they even leave so that you can at least deal with that trigger? So this conversation, this little pilot program, has opened up the opportunities, I think, for all of us to work better statewide. So, and I do want to say, Vivitrol or Suboxone or Methadone, there's no perfect ideal answer. To me, it has to be a voluntary acceptance of wanting something. You can't force somebody into recovery. They have to be a partner in that recovery. So I don't want to leave with the idea that a shot of Vivitrol is going to save you. It's just a way.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. You know, parents often say, you get this injection of Vivitrol or else, right? And so these children will go to no ends, including bringing in their friends' clean urine so they can get a shot of Vivitrol, which puts them into a really nasty withdrawal.
Because they do have drugs in their system.
Because someone else is telling them, you have to stop or else. And mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, the people that are wholeheartedly successful, and that may be some of the success in our data that we collected with Partners Reentry Center, was that these people actually are motivated and they want to get better. Mm-hmm. I really, because I'm on the side that's going to be prescribing the treatment, people don't come into me wanting to be addicted or dependent on opioids. You know, they come to me because they want help. Unless the parents are forcing them to come in. So I really think that that is the wrong approach.
Voluntary is key.
Yeah. I think that because, you know, as Dr. Butler talked about, heroin was around in the 60s and people had a vision of who used it. I would like both of you to talk. I know, Kathleen, you're dealing with people reentering society. Jill, what are your customers like?
I would venture, if I said everyone who's listening today, I bet that everyone who is listening today knows somebody who has been affected, deeply affected by somebody who's dependent on opioids. This does not affect any one socioeconomic class. I see it going across all types of people are affected by this, mm-hmm. you know, epidemic. It is not one group that we can go to and say, let's take care of this high-risk group.
Right.
But people who are using opioids are putting themselves into a high-risk group, as we're seeing the rates of hepatitis C are just skyrocketing in the state. I mean, 60% of people who, you know, are using heroin are getting hepatitis
Hep C.
So
right, which is
it's kind of this blossoming health, you know, problem epidemic that we are creating.
Right. I'm going to welcome Bill to Hometown Alaska. You've got a question, Bill?
You were talking about naltrexone, and I've been using it long-term. I drank for about 20 years pretty hard, and there was some drug use in there. And I, after about 5 years of I'm clean for 5 years, I'm having a hard time stabilizing my moods. So I started taking low doses, 5 milligrams of naltrexone, and I've been doing it for 10 years, and it works for me. And it's really hard to get a prescription for a low dose because it is, you know, for the label, it's for something else. But it works for me.
Go ahead, Jill.
They're using low-dose naltrexone for lots of things. There's our physicians out there who are on the East Coast who are using low-dose naltrexone to control symptoms associated with MS. So we are seeing increased utilization of naltrexone for other disease states and using it low-dose long-term. They're using naltrexone oral at a very low dose in a, along with an antidepressant as a prescription to control obesity.
Really? Wow.
And I, after I had went through chemotherapy, I asked my doctor, the oncologist, to prescribe it, and he looked at me like I was from the moon.
See, that's one, and that's just one of those barriers that we're that I'm meeting is that we have to get providers comfortable with this medicine. I mean, naltrexone is a really safe medication, and but one of the huge barriers is patient and provider perception.
Right.
And I think it's also.
Asked me, she says, "Have you taken your naltrexone today? Because I'll get these moods." It used to be I could think or feel, but I couldn't do both, but I can do both now. I'm going to hang up. Very good show. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for calling and contributing. I really appreciate it. Were you going to jump
in?
Yeah,
I think when we talk about, you know, I think we talked about education, not just public. We got to remember, though, there's also provider education that the this model, this response model needs to need focus on. A lot of times, I think the general public assumes providers know everything. They know what naltrexone is. They know what medicated assisted treatment is. And so we need, we're working very hard to make sure we have the, there's tools and capabilities mm-hmm. for providers to understand all the different options.
You know, when I first started reading about this, I was sort of like, who to be mad at? And I was thinking, I want to be mad at somebody like Big Pharma or yep. whatever. And what I've kind of learned is that there's many contributing factors. In fact, one that we had, we have about, I don't know, 4 minutes left. So think about what's the most important thing on your mind that you want to make sure we leave people with. But the idea that why we gravitate towards these things, why we have addictions, you know, we can have healthy addictions, we can have a running addiction. What is it about this that is part of being human? And I don't know where we can go with that, but I'm trying to embrace the entire audience, and people might think, I'm never going to have an opioid addiction, but perhaps you're in a situation where you could.
I mean, just quickly, what I firmly believe is most of the people that come into our program will tell me the reason they got addicted to heroin was because they got a segue of prescription medication because of an injury or because they were young kids and they were going into their parents'
medicine chests.
Mm-hmm. And we as a society and as a state have to take responsibility for putting our children and ourselves at risk by there is overprescribing. There is also just a lack of seriousness about the effects of prescription medications.
Go ahead, Jill, jump in.
I think there's also, too, if you really ask, you know, sit down and talk with my patients, a lot of people have a history of trauma. And history of trauma really does injure the brain and is a perfect storm for, you know, having someone who is going to go to the easiest fix for something that's going to make their brain feel good.
Right. This is the early childhood ACEs,
yes, ACEs.
Adverse experiences, which we had a show on that a while ago, and I know
right.
I know line one that, is had shows.
That plays a big part, too.
And right. It goes into sort of the expense later on in life, whether it's incarceration or lost jobs or lack of education, because people aren't able to get on a successful track for some reason. And you think that it also, the trauma leads people to seek relief?
Right.
Is that what you're kind of
and
saying?
That coupled with, I think we just, you know, failed to learn great coping skills and using a broad range of activities throughout our day to make our brain feel good. You know, we have to teach our children to find pleasure in all types of ways, not just any one thing too much. Right.
Right. And Andy, you and I were talking before about taking the time to be healthy, you know, as yeah. opposed to give me a pill so I can feel better right now. But there are lots of things you can do to make yourself feel better. And we maybe need to reintroduce those into our There goes the magic music. Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate all of you. Dr. Jay Butler calling in from Juneau, Andy Jones, Kathleen McLaughlin, and Jill Green. And of course, I appreciate our listeners and callers who contributed today. I'll be back as your host next week when we feature Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. My co-host is Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, and our topic is the juvenile justice system. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.